I've been asked to speak on the question, how does my discipline, which I would most simply define as the study of literature, how does it relate to the human search for God? Strangely, or not so strangely, the first thing I thought of was a poem that seemed to depict the opposite, the human flight from God. I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind, and in the mist of tears I hid from him, and under running laughter. This is the beginning of Francis Thompson's great poem, The Hound of Heaven. God is the hound, hunting a human soul. The reason for the flight and for the fear is spelled out in the poem. Though I knew his love who followed, yet was I sore adread, lest, having him, I must have naught beside. But the need to flee seems to be a capitulation to one of two conflicting instincts. Fear wist not to evade, the poem says. Fear wist not to evade as love wist to pursue. The feeling is ambivalent. The psychoanalyst and pediatrician Donald Winnicott considered that artistic creativity was based in two impulses in tension: the urgent need to communicate and the still more urgent need not to be found. This is the kind of tension we can see overtly in The Hound of Heaven, imagined there as a spiritual struggle, where the communication, imperfectly evaded, would be with a God felt to be both loving and impinging. But to the extent that such a conflict can be seen in all artistic writing, reading imaginative literature could be regarded as a process of seeking, finding but never completely, respecting, even appreciating, the right to hide and the importance of ambivalence, indirectness, and implication. It may be, subject to certain conditions, that the sensitive, empathetic attentiveness that readers and critics of poetry are called upon to adopt in order to respond and do justice to subtlety and complexity may be of value to the moral imagination beyond the limits of literature. The Victorian critic Walter Pater thought so, and he was thinking of the status of poetical justice when he wrote the following. The idea of justice involves the idea of rights, but at bottom, rights are equivalent to that which really is, to facts. And the recognition of his rights, therefore, the justice he requires of our hands, or our thoughts, is the recognition of that which the person in his inmost nature really is. And as sympathy alone can discover that which really is in matters of feeling and thought, true justice is in its essence a finer knowledge through love. Justice, in that view, whether inside or outside of poetry in the widest sense, imaginative literature, is a seeking for inmost complexity through sympathetic aliveness to nuance. What I would add to that this evening is that finer justice arising from a finer knowledge through love, in Pater's words, might be one way of expressing the central message of the New Testament, a refinement of God's justice in dealing with humanity, brought about through a loving gesture in which God is brought closer to humanity and humanity is able to come closer to the divine through love or sympathy. If there is such a thing as poetic thinking, I suppose it would be a kind of thought in which something can mean two things at once, Everything is connected with something else, or is something else. Through metaphor, latent symbolic equivalence, ironies and ambiguities, which makes it very good at housing conflict and duality. Love and hate, good and bad, reverence and resentment, faith and doubt. Should we, as individuals, as a culture, as institutions, should, for example, the church, accept these dualities and conflicts as, in Pater's words, that which really is, as moral and psychological fact, data preceding conduct? Or is it possible to deny and suppress the darker sides of experience, and I hesitate to add the sillier sides of experience, without what is sometimes called bad faith? In the words of a 20th century poet, C.H. Sisson, the Christian faith should not be exclusive in the fools it chooses, but take people as they are, knotty, earthly, and divided. This was the message he saw in an earlier poet, John Donne. The realization, as Sisson puts it, that the vain, the ambitious, and the highly sexed are the natural prey of the incarnate Christ. For him, the incarnation seems to be not only an instance, but an acceptance of such duality, God's offer to reach a new accommodation with fallen human nature. I come back to Winnicott, the urgent need to communicate and the still more urgent need not to be found. Perhaps those who are conscious of searching for God may feel that they also are looking for something or someone that wants to communicate, but whose hiddenness, mystery, and unknowability must also be accepted. Here I am reminded particularly of the book of Job, its emotional expressions of ambivalence towards God, who does, in fact, communicate with Job, but remains inscrutable, in the whirlwind, and in his speech insisting on his own inscrutability. The release of Job's indignation must be one of the main reasons for the powerful hold the book has on the imagination. Even the most virtuous of people may be brought face to face with their own latent ambivalence, aggression, and spiritual pride under the right or the wrong circumstances. Faced with a God who can seem willfully inscrutable, poetry can make room for ambivalence. It can even make a virtue of it by expressing it in complex language that we appreciate in its very complexity. The poem can express many-sided, often conflictual experiences without constituting an absolute proposition or a balanced opinion. To borrow a phrase my students have sometimes used, it's a mood. In one very striking poem, Alice Mennell says that God, through the incarnation, has experienced every path of lowliness that mankind is condemned to, apart from one. We pardon one another, as religion tells us to do, and as we may be pardoned by God. But to be pardoned is to be humbled. She says to God, "Give heed. Look at the mournful world thou hast decreed. The time has come. At last we hapless men know all our haplessness all through. Come then, endure undreamed humility, Lord of heaven, come to our ignorant hearts and be forgiven." God has something to be forgiven for. She's ready to forgive. And yet to forgive is in some sense to humiliate, to turn the tables, to make God feel what human life is like. I don't know of any more powerful poem of devout ambivalence. And it comes a long way from the book of Job. So I circle back around to the Hound of Heaven. At the end of the poem, the fleeing soul gives up. God speaks. Ah, fondest, blindest, weakest, I am he whom thou seekest. Thou dravest love from thee who dravest me. If an ordinary person said this to us, we would probably be suspicious or annoyed. If they followed us around, as God does in the poem, with unhurrying chase and unperturbed pace, and kept saying such things, we would be very reasonable for us to call the police, I think. But God is not an ordinary person, and there is no fitting analogy for that relationship. So no wonder if it inspires mixed feelings. And yet this is not God speaking. It may not even be the poet's fiction of God speaking. What the voice of God says in the poem seems to include all the protagonist's self-hatred and self-contempt, while at the same time offering the love he craves. The speech seems to be the fleeing soul's own idea of God's voice, couching God's pursuing love or grace in words that the speaker's own conscience is scripting. The speaker of the poem in this interpretation is identifying with and molding his God, first in a paranoid way, then with a longing for love and acceptance, but still projecting into God's voice the harshness he feels he deserves. And all of this is imagined by, projected from, the real historical poet. Alice Mennel, or her poetic alter ego, invites God, as we saw, to come and be forgiven. In another poem about motherhood, she herself wants forgiveness from her children for having brought them into the world. Now she is the parental figure looking for the forgiveness she feels she needs, the same forgiveness she needs to offer God. The two poems taken together show another version of this shifting and blurring of roles and relations. It's through identifications and imagining such as these that poets and readers, including critics, are able to make literary evocation part of a speculative, experimental, often empathetic, sometimes ambivalent search for what is hard to conceive, including God. And especially if the object sought is in some sense, and in this case by virtue of the incarnation above all, similar to ourselves and to our own experiences, though in other ways inscrutable and irreducibly alien. Thank you.